Dr. Ellen Baumler was a longtime interpretive historian at the Montana Historical Society. She retired 2 weeks ago. So now she's free as a bird to do things like this. She received her PhD from the University of Kansas in English, History, and Classics. And she's the award-winning author of numerous books. I'm sure you've seen some of her books in print and articles. And she was the curator of the Montana Historical Society's recent exhibit about Chinese history. It was called The Forgotten Pioneers. She has taught Montana history in classrooms across the state, and she is a popular member of the Humanities Montana Speakers Bureau. And in 2011, she was honored with the Governor's Award for the Humanities. Again, Ellen retired in July after 26 years with the Historical Society. So this evening, she's going to talk about Montana's pioneer Jewish communities, a topic really we don't know very much at all about. So we're really thrilled to have Ellen come and speak to us. And with no further ado, welcome Ellen Baumler.
Thank you, Leslie. I'll try to live up to that lovely introduction. I am not Jewish, but I did have the privilege of preparing the National Register nominations for the Home of Peace Cemetery in Helena and the Temple of Emmanuel in Helena. And so I knew a little bit about the Jewish communities, but I know a lot more now. I've done this research, and I'm sure that some of you, maybe most of you in the audience, know things that I don't know or know more than I do. And so hopefully we'll have a chance at the end to have a discussion, and you can correct me if I make any mistakes that you note. So I think we have to look first at the larger picture, and then we'll sort of look at the West, and then we'll focus on Montana and the first Jewish communities, particularly in Virginia City, Helena, and Butte. We'll spend time on Helena because that's where the first congregation organized, and we have a detailed record of the struggles that they faced, and I think those struggles are probably typical of most remote communities. And then I will sort of provide a very brief inventory of Judaism in Montana's major cities today. So I think we have to look at these definitions because the terminology will come up. Most of the Jewish congregations, well, all of the Jewish congregations, there are three branches. And these are the three branches, but within the branches, there are also other groups. But the main ones are Reform, which is the most assimilated of the religion's branches. Members may not attend the temple often, but they maintain a connection to their Jewish roots. Orthodox, of course, is the oldest group, and today it is the smallest group. Members are religious in their everyday life. They wear traditional garb and follow strict moral codes. And then finally, conservative Jews represent a middle ground between Reform and Orthodox. And again, you know, within each of these branches in any congregation, you necessarily find smaller divisions or families that practice one of the other two branches. So keep these definitions in mind as we look at the history. This is a Hebrew prayer book for travelers. The American Jewish population in 1840 was only 15,000. By 1860, this small ethno-religious group had rapidly grown in the United States to a much more significant population of 150,000. This miniature daily prayer book was printed in Germany in 1842, and it was especially for travelers by sea to the nation of America. It's the first of three editions, and it was published between 1840 and 1860, a period when Jews from German lands immigrated to this country in the tens of thousands. Political unrest and economic hardship were primary motivating factors for this really large migration. Entire villages migrated to America, and here you have Castle Garden, which is in New York City, and most of them, or all of them, when they came through New York, this was before Ellis Island was founded, which was founded in 1892. So this is where they would have come for processing. By the time Ellis Island was established, Jews were an integral part of many American communities in eastern cities such as New York and Chicago, and across the United States as well. But the California Gold Rush of the 1850s saw Jewish merchants, like you see here, play an important role as provisioners and exchange agents. They dominated the clothing and dry goods businesses as well as tobacco and liquor sales. And, you know, it wasn't easy for these folks who traveled from one camp to the next or conducted business in the bustling Western boom towns. Dispersion posed a significant religious problem, you know, for Jews, because without a minyan, which is a prayer quorum, communal worship couldn't take place, nor could frontier settlers living apart from their fellow Jews easily conform to the rhythm of Jewish life with its weekly Sabbath on Saturday and its holidays that fell on American workdays. So one such isolated peddler prayed into his diary, and I quote, "Thou knowest my thoughts, thou alone knowest my grief, when on the Sabbath's eve I must retire alone to my lodging, and on Saturday morning carry my pack on my back, profaning the holy day. I can't live as a Jew." Another peddler kept careful track of his observances and calculated that over the course of 3 years, he was able to observe the Sabbath properly fewer than 10 times. The largest Jewish community was in New York City, but the second largest was at San Francisco, where Jews established benevolent societies, synagogues, and consecrated burial grounds. The second, San Francisco Temple Emmanuel, that you see here in this slide, was constructed in 1866, and you can see how it towered over the San Francisco skyline, and it was the first building seen by those arriving by ship as they passed through the Golden Gate. Jewish merchants also sent goods to the Pacific Northwest that often originated in San Francisco, and they formed partnerships and links to brothers, uncles, and cousins that formed a very far-reaching chain. Some followed the gold rushes, like this miner here. Well, here you see as a 20th century merchant advertisement in San Francisco's Jewish newspaper. And miners like this guy, Sam Oppenheimer, some followed the gold rushes like he did, and earnings in the form of gold dust and nuggets often went to networks of family employers in San Francisco. As the Western gold rushes to Nevada, Colorado, and Montana opened other mining communities, Jews seized these entrepreneurial opportunities and became miners, but also barbers, tailors, jewelers, bankers, attorneys, and cattlemen. While peddling was a common starting point for many Jewish immigrants in the 19th century, it was especially in the roles of merchant and provider that offered a stepping stone for these enterprising men. Many of them were immigrants from poor villages in Poland, Germany, Prussia, and Austria, and it allowed them to move on to other entrepreneurial pursuits and rapidly gain economic stability and civic status in a single generation, which is really pretty amazing. In the East and in the West, Jewish business owners contributed to local economies and founded empires. Adam Gimbel, for example, who started out peddling notions along the Mississippi River, opened a small business in Vincennes, Indiana, and under his sons, it became the Eastern giant Gimbel Brothers department store. Levi Strauss is a name, of course, that's still familiar to us today. He settled in San Francisco in 1853, and his denim jeans made Levi's a household word that everybody knows even today. And here in remote Montana, in some of the most isolated places in the West, Jews began to establish communities and became a very vital part of Montana's diverse melting pot. Gold discovery along Grasshopper Creek in 1862 led to the founding of Bannock, Montana's first boomtown. Certainly Jewish merchants and peddlers found their way there. One of those was Samuel Schwab, who was born in Rimpar, Bavaria, and rode the first stage from Salt Lake City to Bannock, bringing goods to peddle to the miners. He arrived August 1st, 1863, just 2 months after gold was discovered at Alder Gulch. Virginia City, Montana was beginning to boom, and many businesses like Samuel Schwab's had to move to the new community of Virginia City. Jewish immigrants left an indelible mark there in several ways. Dry goods merchant Solomon Content was one of 11 Jewish businessmen in Virginia City when he built the town's most impressive commercial building in 1864. This was Content's Corner, which is today a primary resource in the Virginia City National Historic Landmark. Another Jewish merchant was Gumpert Goldberg, who left his name stenciled over the doorway of his Wallace Street business, although now it's been overwritten and the building is actually known as the McGovern Store. But the Goldbergs, according to the pioneer reminiscence of Mary Ronan, were her family's close neighbors, and Mrs. Goldberg was a very kindly woman. The Jewish community kept their traditions on the frontier, and in 1865, Mrs. Goldberg served a Passover feast at sundown to all the Jewish residents of Virginia City. Mary was invited to help serve, and Helena Goldberg generously filled a basket of good things to eat for Mary to take to her family. During the turbulent first years, the vigilantes that organized included Jews. And here you have one of the, I think, the very first photograph of Nevada City, 4th of July, 1865. Ben Ezekiel was born to Jewish parents in England and served as one of the two sentries during the Nevada City trial of George Ives, which was the catalyst to the forming of the vigilantes. Ezekiel went on to serve in public office and law enforcement as chief clerk of the House during several legislative sessions and as legislator from Madison County. Samuel Schwab, like Ezekiel, who I mentioned before, was also active in the early community and is listed in the roster as a vigilante. This is Louis Hirschfield. In addition to his dry goods store, Louis Hirschfield established one of Virginia City's very first banks, storing gold as well as exchanging gold dust for currency. By the mid-1860s, some report that as many as 30,000 people were living in the greater Alder Gulch area. And there were many ethnic groups at the time during this early period that included African Americans, Chinese, and of course, Jews. A Hebrew Benevolent Society formed very briefly in Virginia City. It was active only long enough to plan a consecrated Hebrew burial ground. Virginia City's first plat map, drawn in 1868 that you see here, clearly shows the Hebrew cemetery. There's an arrow pointing to that, and here's a little enlargement that shows you, it says Hebrew 27 is the name, the number of the lot. However, not all elements on the plat map came to fruition. There are no records of any Jewish burials in Madison County, and the Benevolent Society never purchased the ground planned for the cemetery. Today, it still belongs to the city of Virginia City. Most of the Jewish community was gone by the time this plat map was drawn in 1868. However, fairly recently, detector dogs, you know, detector dogs detect human remains, indicated that there are burials in that area. I don't believe they're Jewish, but perhaps they represent a potter's field or unrecorded deaths from an early epidemic, maybe even Chinese. But that property remains city-owned today. Virginia City Jews, like Solomon Content, were typically buried not in Virginia City, but in Helena, as we will discuss momentarily. Isidore Strasburger, who was born in 1838 in Warsaw, Russia, came to New York in 1854 and moved on to Ohio and then to Kentucky, to Missouri, and then to Denver in 1859, where he was a merchant. He arrived at Bannock in May of 1863, actually ahead of Samuel Schwab, and soon moved on to Virginia City, where he was an active merchant there for 20 years. In 1883, he transferred to Bozeman, and you see his advertisement from the Bozeman Chronicle there. And then he was there from 1883 to about 1885, and then he went to Butte, where he became a very well-known furniture dealer and died in 1907. Strasburger married Rachel Cohen in Virginia City in 1867. Their wedding is a good example of how the Jewish communities kept traditions without a rabbi. It was a little scandalous because the couple's friends had arranged a civil ceremony, as the law required, actually, in the absence of a religious official. So they had abducted Rachel from her parents, who opposed the match. Rachel's father already had made a match for her. But after the couple was legally married in this civil ceremony, the parents gave in and gave a beautiful, proper wedding for her. However, in the absence of a rabbi, a merchant was appointed acting rabbi, and the service was conducted in Hebrew. The ceremony was performed with all the traditional rites required. Territorial Governor Greenclay Smith, who, of course, was not Jewish, And Virginia City's most prominent citizens, who probably weren't Jewish either, were among the 140 guests. All remained with their hats on, according to Orthodox custom. As the placer gold dwindled in 1865 and 1866, Virginia City residents moved on to Helena. Here you see the first photograph of Helena in 1865. These included most Jewish businessmen like Gumpert Goldberg, Louis Hirschfield, David and Moses Morris, Marcus Lissner, Louis Kaufman, and Samuel Schwab. Others like Ben Ezekiel, clerk of the territorial court, came to Helena later in 1875 when it became the new territorial capital and all the territorial officials transferred there. A few, like Isidore Strasburger, remained in Virginia City for some time after that. Helena's founding at Last Chance in 1864, like Virginia City and Bannock, counted Jews among its very first businessmen, like the Morris Brothers crockery business and the Sands Brothers dry goods that you see here. Very early picture of the Sands Brothers. Marcus Lissner operated the International Hotel from 1869 for decades after that. Samuel Schwab and his partner and son-in-law, Edward Zimmerman, ran the Cosmopolitan Hotel. Jacob Feldberg, Israel Israel, and Herman Gans each had retail clothing businesses. Louis Kaufman invested his Alder Gulch earnings, mining profits, in the Helena meat market. And from the town's first formative years, Helena's Jews contributed in major ways to the local economy. As Montana's population leapfrogged from Bannock to Virginia City and finally to the new camp at Helena, Louis Hirschfield opened a Helena branch of his Virginia City bank in 1865. And by 1890, it had grown with numerous partners who were both Jews and Gentiles. And here we have a first page of the Hebrew Benevolent Society Day Book. On December 9, 1866, Jewish businessmen formally established the Hebrew Benevolent Society of Helena. It seems that the same group probably established the society in Virginia City and then moved it to Helena because the same names appear. Hebrew benevolent societies were common in communities across the United States where there were substantial Jewish residents. These early societies had specific functions. There are no surviving formal documents recording Virginia City's benevolent society, but Helena's organization is very well documented and the records are preserved in the archives of the Montana Historical Society. There are two record books. This is the first one. This book spans the period from December 3rd, 1866 through 1872. And the second one, there's a little bit of a gap. And the second one spans the period from 1879 to 1943. These records tell us a lot about the Jewish community and the challenges that they faced. Although Helena's Jews had no synagogue and no rabbi, as was often the case in Western communities, the Benevolent Society bound the group together. Members, as in Hebrew Benevolent Societies in other places across the West, maintained Jewish holidays, conducted prescribed rituals, offered financial assistance to the needy, saw to the medical care and burial of victims of accidents, disease, and violence, and encouraged charitable acts. The Minute Book details the first burials and activities of the society. A major purpose was to establish and maintain Hebrew burial grounds. The Home of Peace was established in 1867, and the society installed the fence that you see here in 1867, and it today still surrounds the property. The first two burials were reinterments from the mining camp cemetery because there was no Hebrew cemetery in 1865 when those two gentlemen died. And this is the oldest active Jewish cemetery in Montana and Helena's oldest cemetery as well. This plot map shows the first 12 burials. You can see that they're at this kind of bizarre angle. Why they're like that, nobody has been able to explain. The deceased were not buried in the order that they're numbered either. But it's likely that these graves were never marked because many, many graves from the 1860s, 70s until the mid-1880s, there was no tombstone maker in Montana. And so many, many graves were never marked. And here you see a current plot map of the cemetery. And later in the 1970s, where you see that practice football field, that area is where those angled burials were, and that area was leased to the Helena School District as a practice football field. And since all the graves there were unmarked, this actually served to keep the grounds maintained, so it wasn't really a bad thing. And there you can see the chain link fence fences off the football field on the other side, and that's where those first angled graves were. In 1869, a situation arose that demonstrates how the society grappled with questions of religious propriety without the counsel of a rabbi. A special meeting was held to discuss the burial of Mary Goldman. According to the Helena Herald, she was not Jewish by birth, but by adoption and by choice. You can see just a piece of her obituary here. Her age is not given, but she was in her girlhood years and apparently had not yet converted or was too young to have done so. Her place of burial and the lack of a rabbi to resolve the question is presumably why there was more than a week's delay in her burial. There was much discussion, and it was finally decided that because of her innocence and her intent, she was granted burial in the Hebrew cemetery. So she was one of those early burials there in 1869. So here you have, there you can see, hers is number two. During this early period, Jews in other communities who died were sent to Helena for burial. That included Solomon Content, who is on there, he's number three. Number three is Solomon Content, who died in 1870 in Virginia City. And B. Wolf, who died in Deer Lodge, he's one of the ones at the end, you don't really see his name there, but he died in 1872 and is the last of the 12 angled burials. Emmanuel Blum, number one there, was the first burial. He was one of those two reinterments from the city cemetery. Information in the minute books is not limited to cemetery business, though, and includes plans and committee appointments regarding fundraising for the society, the observance of religious holidays, acquisition of religious items, and discussions of plans to build a synagogue. As Helena endured a series of devastating fires between 1869 and 1874, it was the Jewish community that helped keep the fledgling mining camp solvent. Here you have a picture of the International Hotel. Many Jewish merchants and businessmen had ties to a financial network that reached well beyond the Montana frontier, allowing access to financial resources to rebuild sometimes again and again. Marcus Lissner, for example, who lost his uninsured but highly acclaimed International Hotel so many times that it became known as the Phoenix. Each time he rebuilt, and like other Helena Jews, he also financially helped many others get started in business or rebuild after fire. By 1877, 20% of Helena's Board of Trade, the forerunner of the Chamber of Commerce, was Jewish. In 1881, Abram Sands, a Jew, was elected president of the organization. Jews served in public offices. Marcus Lissner, for example, was elected to the city council six different times. And Jewish citizens maintained some of Helena's most beautiful homes and were not only well-respected, but also embraced by the Gentile community. Jews were lawyers, judges, bankers, merchants, service providers, and business partners with non-Jews. Here you see the home of Morris Silverman. Jewish banking houses were instrumental in the process of capital formation in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Modern banking in Europe and the United States was influenced by Jewish financiers, such as the Rothschild and Warburg families. And Jews were major contributors to the establishment of important investment banks on Wall Street. German Jews founded investment banking firms, which later became mainstays of the industry. Most prominent Jewish banks in the United States were investment banks, not commercial banks. J&W Seligman & Company, founded in 1864, was a prominent U.S. investment bank from the 1860s to the 1920s. The Seligman family financed the construction of several railroads and the Panama Canal. Albert Joseph Seligman came to Montana in 1881 from New York City to oversee his family's heavy investments in Montana mining enterprises. Seligman and the family financial backing that he commanded became an important factor in the development of Helena and Montana territory. During and following the 1893 silver panic, Seligman and his money helped save a number of Montana businesses that might otherwise have been closed. His spectacular home that you see here was designed by renowned architect Cass Gilbert in 1886, and it's one of the truly lavish homes on Helena's west side. The prestigious Montana Club, as you see here, which was founded in 1885, counted prosperous, well-educated Jews like clothier Herman Gans of the firm of Gans and Klein among its elite members. And Louis Kaufman partnered with Gentile Louis Stadler to form one of Montana's largest cattle operations. In fact, the two of them employed Charlie Russell during the winter of 86-87 when Russell drew this famous last of the 5,000 postcard for his bosses. Many of Helena's Jews, like other citizens, were also Masons, and this is the Masonic Hall in Virginia City. And this affiliation in Helena and elsewhere drew Jews and Gentiles together in fraternal brotherhood. By the end of the 1880s, Helena's Jewish population remained organized, but still without a rabbi or a synagogue. Services were held in various meeting halls and Helena churches. Rabbi Samuel Shulman came to lead the Helena congregation at the end of the 1880s. Rabbi Shulman brought with him German Reform Judaism, which fit well with Helena's many Jews of German extraction. Under Rabbi Shulman, the congregation's dream of building the first temple amidst the Rockies reached fruition. And here you see the Temple Emmanuel. A committee formed to teach the architects, Frederick Heinlein and Thomas F. Matthias, who were not Jewish, what the temple should look like and what elements were necessary. The Moorish-style building was stunning, an architectural anomaly that added greatly to the cosmopolitan image that Helena wanted to portray at that point. Governor Joseph K. Toole, who was not Jewish, laid the cornerstone of the first synagogue between St. Paul, Minnesota, and Portland, Oregon. Speaking to a crowd of visitors of all creeds from distant places, he said, and I quote, "Conscious of the sacred duty which I have been invited to perform, I now have the honor of laying the first cornerstone of the first Jewish temple in the state of Montana." The cornerstone is inscribed with the date, according to the Jewish calendar, and the granite marker was put at the foundation's northwest corner. Inside were the names of congregation members, cards of those present, coins, a quartz specimen, copies of the Helena Independent, and the cornerstone remains there today. Symbolic keyhole windows and twin towers crowned with onion domes made the temple a most striking building. Beautiful rose windows and stained glass of many colors softened the rich interior of crimson, blue, and gold. The sanctuary rose to a 30-foot ceiling with a seating capacity of 500. As the second generation of Jewish pioneers came of age, the Helena congregation reached its peak in the 1890s, but after 1900, educational opportunities and employment took many of the second generation away from Montana. The close-knit population began to dwindle. Into the 20th century, the Minute Book records families moving away from Helena. This is the cemetery gate to the Home of Peace, which was installed right about this time. In 1910, the Cemetery Association, the descendant of the Hebrew Benevolent Society, merged with the Congregation Emmanuel. The combining of these two entities is truly indicative of the diminishing of the number of Helena Jews. However, Helena continued to embrace the Jewish community, and this is a poster for the YWCA. In 1911, when the Helena YWCA was founded, Frieda Fliegelman was its very first secretary. Frieda was so instrumental in the success of the Helena YWCA that the YWCA chose not to affiliate with the national organization. Its rule that persons who were not Christian could not participate in management or decision-making meant that Frieda, who was Jewish, could have no role. In 1972, Helena's YWCA was the only independent chapter in the United States, and did not affiliate until the 1980s. During the early 1900s, the waning of Helena's Jewish population is in further evidence. You know, there was a lot of hope that the cemetery would expand, not that they wanted people to die, but that the cemetery would expand, and you can see what happened here. Only a portion of the cemetery was actually ever used. But as marriages during this time period between Jews and Gentiles among Helena families became more frequent, the once stringent cemetery rules began to relax. Before 1900, only persons of the Jewish faith could be buried in the Jewish cemetery. The Board of Trustees realized, though, that intermarriage was becoming prevalent and agreed to change this rule to include Gentile spouses and their unmarried children, and even to allow non-Jewish funerals. Meanwhile, to backtrack a little bit to Butte, this is Henry Jacobs, who was a prominent Jewish clothing merchant who got his start in business in Diamond City before he came to Butte in 1876. He was elected mayor of Butte in 1879, and he built the first brick home in Butte. He also served as city treasurer and school trustee, and Butte's third mayor, H.L. Frank, was also Jewish and served two elected terms from 1885. While Helena's earliest population was largely comprised of former Virginia City residents, including Jews, a substantial community of immigrant Jews developed a little bit later at Butte. Here you have a Jewish merchant delivering goods. Although there were some Jewish businesses like Gans and Klein that operated in both Butte and Helena, Jews attracted to Butte were different from those who settled in Helena. Because of the copper mining industry, the town's industrial personality was unique, and Jews of this community necessarily came from a wider range of European countries to work the mines, to peddle goods, and establish businesses. Unlike Helena, where most of the Jews came from Prussia or Germany and practiced Reform Judaism, Butte's Jews reflected a much wider geographic diversity, and thus religious practices were more obviously different among them. In 1881, Butte's first wave of Jewish citizens had formed a Hebrew Benevolent Association and celebrated the first Holy Day services. As in Helena, the association preceded establishing a congregation. Although its first recorded burial dates to 1880, the B'nai Israel Cemetery that you see here formally opened in 1885. There are between 500 and 1,000 graves in the cemetery, but a count is really not forthcoming just because so many graves were unmarked. The second wave of Jews were refugees of religious persecution from Russia, Romania, Hungary, Poland, and Ukraine. Unlike the Germans, they were devoutly Orthodox in their religious practices and brought with them a bias towards Butte's growing Reform movement. Butte's Jewish community quickly split into Orthodox and Reform congregations, and the Orthodox group split further into two groups, and then at one point even into three. A kosher butcher in the retail space of the Knights of Pythias Hall served the needs of the Orthodox community. Whereas Helena's Jewish population was diminishing, Jewish families continued to immigrate and settle in Butte. And here you have a New Year's greeting card with Americanized Russian Jews on one side beckoning to their refugee relatives around 1900. In the early 1900s, estimates of Butte's Jewish community ranged from 500 to 1,000. The B'nai Israel Reform Congregation formed in 1897, and construction of the synagogue began on the corner of Washington and Galena, and the building was officially dedicated in 1903 that you see here. Previously, the congregation worshipped in the Carpenters Union Hall and in the Mountain View Episcopal Church. In 1902, the Orthodox community converted the German Lutheran Church into the Adith Israel Congregation Synagogue. Adith Israel Synagogue was demolished when underground mining threatened the building, and the congregation moved to the Knights of Pythias Hall until 1955, when this building burned. The only thing that was rescued from the fire was the Sefer Torah, the scroll that was used in the ritual of Torah reading during Jewish prayers, and that did survive. Butte's two congregations, the Adith Israel and the B'nai Israel, joined together in the 1960s. B'nai Israel is the oldest synagogue in Montana, still in use as a synagogue, again, built in 1903, and one of only a few in the United States that does retain its Moorish-style onion dome. In addition to the Masonic lodges, Butte's unifying Judaic organization was B'nai B'rith, which helped promote social contact between the disparate groups in Butte and Jews in other Montana towns. Founded in New York in 1843, the International Fraternal Organization continues today to advocate for Israel, provide humanitarian relief, and better the lives of people around the globe. As in Helena and other Montana communities, the various congregations had women's and youth groups, and many Jews were Masons, some of them of the very highest degree. Women belonged to the women's counterpart, Eastern Star. Butte further had youth organizations, and for several decades in the early 1900s, there was a Hebrew school. These immigrants loved their adopted country and its freedom. Frida Fliegelman, whom I mentioned before, was the daughter of Romanian Jews. Her father, Herman, long operated the New York store, which was one of Montana's first department stores. This good luck quilt that was sewn by Minnie Fliegelman, Frida's mother, illustrates that point with Liberty in the middle, centered in the quilt. It's kind of interesting that the quilt was made from her husband's fabric samples from the store. Although Butte's Jewish community continued to grow into the 20th century while Helena's diminished, one Helena couple made significant statewide contributions during this time, and here you have their two headstones. Saul Heppner, who was Lewis and Clark County prosecuting attorney, Helena city attorney, and a state representative, was a past Grand Master of the Masons Grand Lodge, AF and AM, of Montana. His wife, Josephine, was a Grand Matron of the Grand Chapter Order of the Eastern Star of Montana. Their individual capacities as highest degree Masons really was instrumental in helping them found the Masonic Home of Montana in 1911, which was originally a home for widows, children, and elderly whose family members were Masons. The home still operates today as a home for elderly Masons. The road to the facility is named Saul Heppner Way. Josephine founded and served as president of the Montana Children's Home, which was a non-denominational orphanage that countered the Catholic St. Joseph's Children's Home and the state orphanage at Twin Bridges. In 1937, Butte businessman Lois Chaudière, who was a friend of Josephine Heppner's, gave $200,000 to found a children's hospital, and the Montana Children's Home became Chaudière Children's Hospital. It was one of the first hospitals to treat children with polio. Today, the hospital provides for the care and treatment of children suffering from illnesses, diseases, and other physical, mental, and emotional conditions. Both of these institutions, the Masonic Home and Chaudière Hospital, founded in the early 1900s, have a far-reaching impact even today. Now, Billings also supported a large Jewish population of a distinct character. Founded in the 1880s to serve the railroad, Billings attracted Jews who arrived by train to peddle goods or trade in hides and furs. Billings Jews were economically poorer than those in Helena and Butte. They didn't usually have family members with them or extended family, as did many Jews in Helena and Butte. And Billings Jews experienced much more prejudice than they did in Helena and in Butte. Establishment of the B'nai B'rith Lodge, number 815 in 1917, was the first step in the organization of the Billings Jewish community. Membership in this organization, as in Butte, drew the Jewish community together. And here you have one of the prominent Jewish figures in Billings, Lewis Herron, and his hide wagon around 1910 or so. When the 1918 flu epidemic stressed Butte's resources, the Butte Lodge informed Billings that the B'nai Israel Cemetery could no longer bury the dead from Billings, and that Billings would have to take care of its own dead. An auction was then held to finance the cemetery, and the highest bidder was asked to name the congregation that would buy the land and maintain the cemetery property. Lewis Herron was the highest bidder and chose the name Beth Aaron, which was a translation of his own name. During the 1920s, when the Ku Klux Klan was active in Billings, anti-Semitism discouraged Jews from mingling with non-Jewish neighbors, and until the 1950s, Jews in Billings were even excluded from membership in the Billings Masonic Lodge, the Highlands Golf Club, and the Junior League. The Billings congregation, originally Orthodox, became a real mixture of conservative, Reform, and Orthodox because of the backgrounds of the members and the diversity. Sabbath services were held on Friday nights in members' homes. The Reform prayer book was used at Friday night services, but the conservative prayer book then was used for holidays. Men wore hats according to Orthodox tradition during services, but men and women sat together, which they didn't do in strictly Orthodox congregations. And no one kept kosher homes. Services were quick, so the men could adjourn for poker and the women for bridge. I have to say that in researching Billings, card playing was an absolute obsession there in the 1920s and 30s, and it's really not surprising that they were anxious to get to their card games. There was a lot of contention among the congregation, so much so that newcomers who came in to join were absolutely shocked. The group expanded and a building was finished, the building that you see here in 1940, built across the street from St. Vincent Hospital. It was built to look like a residence so that it wouldn't attract too much attention. Billings' population grew due to the Williston Basin oil boom after World War II, and although it was organized as an Orthodox congregation, newcomers from bigger cities were used to Reform temples, and so they led the movement to join the Union of American Hebrew Congregations in 1953, which is the Reform arm of American Jewry, and hired an ordained Reform rabbi. The Billings community was not particularly welcoming for the first half of the 20th century, but gradually Jews were more accepted. This became evident in the 1990s when the entire community rallied around their Jewish neighbors. Hate crimes against Jews and other groups set the town on edge. Some of you probably remember in 1993 when a brick came hurling through 5-year-old Isaac Schnitzer's bedroom window. Isaac was fortunately uninjured, but a menorah displayed in his window as a symbol of the family's celebration of Hanukkah made the Schnitzers a target of religious bigotry and vandalism. The Schnitzers were among the few Jewish families in Billings. Supremacist groups began to commit brutal hate crimes against various minorities. Billings suffered desecration of its Jewish cemetery, telephone threats to its Jewish citizens, and swastikas were painted on the home of an interracial couple. The Schnitzers were advised to remove the religious symbols from public view. This infringed upon their First Amendment right to religious freedom. News reports left Christians wondering what it would be like if a Christmas tree in the windows of their own homes invited violence. An idea quickly took root. Menorahs like this one published in the Billings Gazette appeared in the windows of some 10,000 homes in Billings, sending a powerful message of community solidarity. Harassment continued and some non-Jewish citizens suffered vandalism, but gradually the perpetrators withdrew. The next December 1994, families in Billings again displayed menorahs, reaffirming their commitment to peace and tolerance. The quiet, courageous message spread and became known as the Not in Our Town National Movement. It is a message that continues to reverberate. This year, the congregation Beth Aaron hosted an open house in its brand new synagogue that you see there. Today, there are active Jewish communities in Billings, Bozeman, Butte, Great Falls, Helena, Kalispell, and Missoula. As of 2014, there is an estimated 1,350 Jews and 5 synagogues in Montana. Bozeman and Missoula have Orthodox and Reform congregations. The Orthodox congregations of both Bozeman and Missoula are more recently established and follow the Chabad Lubavitch Orthodox Hasidic movement. Chabad is today one of the world's best-known Hasidic movements and is well-known for its outreach. Bozeman's Beth Shalom Reform Congregation celebrated its first Passover in 1982, while Missoula's Har Shalom goes back to the 1940s. To return to Helena and the Temple Emmanuel for a moment, in 1937, the state of Montana purchased the temple building from the diminished congregation for a dollar and a promise that they would use the building for a good and social purpose. A second story was added and all religious symbolism was removed, including the onion domes and the words "Gate to the Eternal" in Hebrew over the doorway. The stained glass, the cornerstone, and the keyhole windows somehow or other remain intact. The building fulfilled the promise of a good and social purpose by housing the Office of Public Welfare until the 1980s. Then the building sat vacant until 1989, when the Catholic Diocese of Helena purchased the building at public auction for use as its offices. Although some have not been very happy about this particular use, the building has been well cared for and, in a rather curious way, has almost come full circle, again fulfilling a religious purpose. On April 21, 2001, a meaningful ceremony marked another milestone in Montana's Jewish history. Maryland businessman, who you see there on the right-hand side, Jerry Klinger, whose parents were victims of the Holocaust but who had absolutely no connection to Montana whatsoever, set in motion members of the Helena Jewish community, Catholic officials, the Montana Historical Society staff, and a handful of descendants of Helena's prominent Jewish pioneers. The building had just been listed in the National Register when this diverse group came together to celebrate the community's significance of the regional landmark. Bishop Robert Morlino of Helena, 92-year-old Sidney Silverman Lindauer, and Joe Schwartz of California, who are both descendants of pioneer families of Helena, addressed the gathering in the spirit of that first community dedication more than a century before. During this ceremony, a small bronze plaque commissioned and paid for by Klinger was unveiled. The plaque marked the beginning, the building's significance, and celebrated its 110th anniversary. Montana's Jewish pioneers faced seemingly insurmountable odds, but although sometimes small in numbers, they were really a mighty force in many of our communities here in Montana. Times have changed, but much remains the same. And as those early Montanans have demonstrated, it was really not an easy road. And it still is not easy for those who wish to follow the Jewish faith. My good friend Janet Tatz has always cautioned me not to make Montana's Jews sound like relics. As we remember the pioneers who came here and established those early congregations, we historians do sometimes tend to emphasize the fact that the Jewish populations dwindled as the second and third generations moved elsewhere. But it is important to remember that they laid the foundation for what is here today. And the Montana congregations, they may not be descendants of those pioneers, but they are here and they are growing, perpetuating the flame that those who came before first kindled. I understand that even today in Montana, it's not always easy to be Jewish. Rebecca Stanfell writes of her experience, and I close with her words and her thoughts on becoming Jewish in Montana. She writes, and I quote, "It's not easy to convert to Judaism in Montana, but then the important tasks we undertake in life rarely are. I struggle over whether to eat unkosher meat, including the buffalo burgers that I have come to adore. Sometimes I think, how can I do this here? Then I remember the men and women laid to rest in the Montana earth in Helena's Jewish cemetery. I think of them gathering around menorahs on a cold, dark evening. I imagine the light flickering off their smiles, and I know that I, too, can celebrate the miracles of light shining in the darkness, of community persisting against the odds, of becoming who I am, where I am." Thank you. So if there are any questions or comments, we'd love to hear them. Stadler and Kaufman, as I mentioned before, they had one of the largest ranches in the Judith Basin, and they're the ones who employed Charlie Russell, who did that very famous last of the 5,000. But yes, there certainly were. And they were partners. Lewis Kaufman was Jewish and Stadler was Gentile, and they were friends for life. And I'm sure there were many others too. Well, I can tell you a story about Ida Levy. Ida Levy was from New York, and she had, I guess, relatives. She had a son that was killed in a car accident, but she had no very close relatives, but she did have some nieces and nephews. And she would make summer trips to New York, and she would take the nieces and nephews around and buy them anything they wanted. And everyone was always very enamored of their Aunt Ida. And so many years later, there was a mother-daughter who appeared at the Montana Historical Society library. And they said to the librarian, you know, we're trying to trace our great Aunt Ida and wondered if her bar is still standing. And so the librarian said, well, we could look in the city directories. Maybe we could find it. You know, what was her name? Her name was Ida Levy. And he just about choked. He just blurted out why she was no bar owner. She was the most notorious madam in Montana, you know, in the 30s. And the niece and her daughter were absolutely floored. They had no idea that Ida made her money in that way, but they thought it was great. They had uncovered Aunt Ida's great secret. So that led to quite a lot of correspondence between me and the niece, and we had a great time comparing notes. But Ida Levy was a very charitable woman, and I wrote favorably about her at one point, and the former county attorney came and screamed at me in my office for calling her a nice woman. She was not a nice woman. But I disagree. I think she was very, very civic-minded, and she was really very careful about who she let into her place. There was a lot of dissension among those Orthodox folks, and I know they immediately split into two and then probably into three and perhaps four also. Yes. Well, thank you all for coming. Appreciate it.